call the Senate Finance and Revenue Committee to order. Welcome, everyone. Today we have a public hearing scheduled, and we also have a work session scheduled on Senate Bill 690. So what I'm going to do is we'll go ahead and have the public hearing on Senate Bill 883, and then the work session on Senate Bill 690 will literally be a work session, and we'll ask people in the audience who have something to contribute on that issue to come up and speak to us, because this is very much a work in progress, shall we say. So I will start out by opening a public hearing on Senate Bill 883. Chris.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 883 allows the Department of Revenue and financial institutions doing business in Oregon to enter into data exchange agreements for the purpose of improving tax compliance and debt collections. The bill identifies which information will be shared for each debtor who maintains an account at the institution and owes a debt to a state agency or to a county that has been assigned to the collections unit in the Department of Revenue. The language in the bill isn't exactly clear on whether it's limited or the effect on income taxes, so I think we'll hear about that today. The bill also requires the department to pay a fee to the financial institutions for conducting the data match and allows the department to impose a fee upon the debtor for conducting the data match. It allows the department to share data with other state agencies or private collection agencies for purposes of collecting these debts, and ensures that financial institutions who are not liable for disclosure of information responding to a notice of lien or levy issued by the department or complying in good faith with the requirements of the bill.
Thank you very much. And we have signed up Steve Marks and David Denneke. I assume you want to talk together. Welcome.
Good afternoon.
Madam Chair, for the record, I'm Steve Marks of the Marks Network, located in Salem, Oregon. I'm here today representing Premier Credit, a debt recovery enterprise in Indianapolis, Indiana. Premier Credit has an interest in promoting modernization of state government debt recovery through the use of business technology, and the company is very involved in working with those processes and systems in Indiana and elsewhere. I'd like to thank the committee chair for the opportunity to have this hearing and testify, and the committee for a chance to discuss the issues of Senate Bill 883. Premier Credit is very interested in working with the Senate Finance and Revenue Committee to help establish a new Oregon system or model for debt recovery. We believe that Senate Bill 883 is a good vehicle to enable that process of reengineering how we do that and how we collect the monies owed to the state, and in this instance of Senate Bill 883, also potentially to counties. However, we are very aware that the committee also has an interest in Senate Bill 690, and that legislation would also enable a data match system for income tax collection debts through Section 8 of that bill. So we want to be very clear that we're committed to work with the committee on your vehicle of choice. We're also committed to working with all of the state interests and stakeholders that need to be a part of this process so that we can have a viable system. There are some compelling policy reasons of cost and policy to support moving forward. No doubt, as you go through a challenging budget period, this probably falls on the list of things that you need to do to help ensure that the state's financial systems are in order. There's the present policy issue of fairness to taxpaying citizens that should be assured and expect that the state will ensure that everyone that pays their share for government services. And beyond these issues, if we can lower cost and improve collection rates through employing practices that improve the speed of business, that builds confidence in the administration of state services overall. So regardless of the vehicle for enactment, several issues are present on implementation of data match, and with me is David Denneke of the Harang Long Gary Rudnick Law Firm that will go through what's contemplated in implementing Senate Bill 883, but I want to talk about some of the issues in general that you will have to decide no matter what course you take. First, under whose authority does such a system operate? Most likely, that's surely the Department of Revenue, with the Department of Justice playing a greater or lesser role in that system. The scope of actions and collections covered. Senate Bill 883 envisions that a data match system will be broadly used for state debt collection and some county collections. Senate Bill 690 is more limited in scope to tax collections, income tax collections. Assignment of collections is an issue. Both bills tend to leave that question to the process of rulemaking through the Department of Revenue to implement a system, and we believe that's the right approach to take in moving forward with proper legislative oversight of that process. There is the issue of reimbursement of financial institutions. The intent of both bills, I think, is to ensure that banks receive a fee for the data match process. Most likely that would be on a per-transaction basis, or that's certainly one way to ensure that banks are compensated for the cost of providing the data. Liability for institutions is also an issue. The inclusion of language that protects banks and debt collectors should they to reduce the impediments and risks and to ensure timely collections would be important, so long as they're following the rules prescribed by the state and following law. Senate Bill 883 currently does not contain such a provision, while Senate Bill 690 does. Inclusion of this provision in Senate Bill 883 would be a desirable feature from our point of view. And then lastly, there's the question of how data match systems or the new systems, how individuals are treated in the new system versus the current process. This is a significant issue, and it's our belief that the use of the data match system does not significantly alter the information that the state must seek and use to enable collection actions. We do see that the volume of information and the transactions will increase because you're dealing with more individuals potentially, yet that's one of the desired goals for creating a timely and efficient system. And with that, I'd say that we would, if we were going to deal with Senate Bill 883 directly, have amendments to that, to some clarifying amendments for that bill. But at this time, I'd like to turn it over to David so he can talk about how that's implemented through 883 in the data match process.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Welcome.
I'm David Denneke from Portland. I'm a lawyer with Harang Long Gary Rudnick, and I'm here with also with another lawyer from Harang Long, Hua Go. Hua and I and Steve Marks have worked with Todd Wolf, who's the president of Premier Credit, to craft this legislation. Todd wishes he could be here today, but he, on short notice, he wasn't able to make the trip here. But Premier Credit has had experience now with this data match system in the state of Indiana, and it appears that the data match system could help the state of Oregon tremendously, and so we're here to promote that effort. I won't repeat what Steve just talked about regarding the use of the bill, but I will tell you that the history is that in 1996, a welfare reform act was passed, which included a provision that created the data match system for collection of child support nationally, and it was imposed on each of the states. And since 1996, the state of Oregon has implemented data match through the Department of Justice and has used it to collect delinquent child support. The purpose of this bill basically is to extend that data match process to the collection of these delinquent accounts through the state of Oregon and to the implementation of procedures to collect the accounts. The way the system works, you may all be familiar with it already, but the system compares the names and the information of the delinquent debtors to the bank information to match up the proper person with the bank account, and then that information under this bill would be provided to the agency that would carry out the collection effort. In this case, we believe it would be the Department of Revenue. And in this case, of course, the Department of Revenue is already in the collection process through the other agency's account unit, and that information would be provided to other agency account or some other unit within the Department of Revenue, and then it would be used essentially as the Department of Revenue sees fit. There is no provision in the bill that requires how the data is matched. There is no provision for how the matched information will be used in collection. And there is no provision as to how the banks will compile and match the information, although I'm sure there are technical ways of doing it. That is not provided for in the bill. The bill simply looks forward to both agency regulations and rules on how to implement the collection effort. I provide an attachment to you with the prepared remarks which show the experience of at least one collector, in this case, Premier Credit, in the state of Indiana, and the success that they have experienced through the use of data match in Indiana. I think the total collections that they were experienced over the first 18 months of the use of data match was over $119 million. And I don't know, I can't remember the exact date that occurred, but I think they're continuing to experience similar experience in Indiana. One of the, and by the way, it's important to realize that the data match system, although it provides for information which might lead to garnishment of bank accounts, for instance, in the experience of Premier Credit, at least in the state of Indiana, 95% of their collections are by voluntary payment, which comes about because of the fact that the data match system becomes known to people in the state, and they may be contacted about the fact that the state has identified their bank account, and pretty quickly people take steps to comply, which usually is through voluntary payment plans with the state. So that is at least the experience in the past, is that most of the payments are become voluntary tax payments or other whatever kind of collection is taking place. The one of the questions I think that has been or will be raised is the question of whether there is unnecessary intrusion on privacy of debtors. And I would only point out to the committee that the same process or a process now exists under state law to question debtors and to obtain exactly the same information and a lot more regarding the debtor's finances, bank accounts, et cetera. And I think as may be said later, also there are subpoenas and orders from courts and other agencies which can require that the same information be produced to a plaintiff in a civil case. And the last thing I would say is that all of the defenses and all of the protections for debtors which have existed in the past continue to exist. And so there's no diminution in the protection of a debtor from unwarranted collection efforts. Thank you.
Thank you very much. In Indiana, and indeed in as you would contemplate this bill, there are two ways to match the data. One is for the agency to send out to banks the names and social security numbers of people with delinquent accounts. The other way is for the banks to just send a disk with all their accounts and to have the agency match it. Which method is used in Indiana?
I do not know, and I'm not sure it's consistent in all cases. I'm not sure. I can certainly provide that to you.
Yes, that would be useful for us to know. I would personally have some concern. I know others do as well. With kind of a data mining operation
from
banks, the issues with that are fairly obvious. Okay. Other questions from the committee? Senator Telfer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Premier Credit worked with Indiana and continues to work with Indiana. Would you also be bidding to do the work here in Oregon?
I think if the bill is passed or a bill is passed, then Premier would want to be qualified to do this in Oregon. They're currently licensed and are a collection agency operating in the state. But the bill is in no way aimed toward Premier Credit or any other collector. It is simply a vehicle to be used to collect.
Follow up based on that comment. But I understood Premier Credit is the one that helped craft.
That's right.
To go to your chart that you have at the end, can you help me understand how that, what these columns mean? Let's go to the individual income tax line toward the bottom. Can you tell me what those...
These accounts, as I understand it, are over 5 years old delinquent income tax accounts in this case, which were part of a group of accounts that the state of Indiana assigned to Premier. Premier was one of many collectors who worked on collecting these amounts in Indiana, and this is the experience that they had over 18 months after the data match system was put in place in Indiana.
Okay, so basically they gave you $55 million worth of accounts, and you had a 59%
correct
return rate, and out of that you netted $33 million.
Correct.
Am I understanding
yes
that correctly?
Yes, that's
okay
right.
All right. Thank you. Other questions from the committee? Senator Rosenbaum.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I apologize if you answered this and I just missed it. But if in the process of this data being gathered, it was some information was inadvertently released that should not have been, who's liable for that?
Well, I would expect that the party responsible for the inadvertent release would be liable for it. I don't know, you know, the facts, but certainly there's liability attached to inadvertently or releasing financial information in an unauthorized way.
Were you referring to the liability protection issue? How does the liability protection issue work?
Well, right now, the bill, I think, does not specify all of the liability protection provisions that we would envision in the bill.
Why don't you be specific about how the liability protection would work if you amended the bill, and how it would work if someone either intentionally or inadvertently released data?
I don't know if that I can answer the question of how liability would attach, but right now I think it's envisioned the bill would provide that there would be no liability attached to the financial institutions that provide the information. I think there's existing law on all the liability associated with an unauthorized release. I don't know that there would be additional information or additional provisions in the bill to cover that, although, Steve, is that something that has been discussed with you?
As I understand, and let me try to portray my understanding of the issue, it's just as long as the collection institutions, the banks, were complying with the regulations prescribed by revenue, then they wouldn't be liable. But if they stood outside and releasing information inadvertently would be outside the rules, presumably, that would still have a liability.
Okay, I think that's the way I would envision it.
That's what I was trying to say.
Yeah, okay. Thank you. Sometimes we need a lay person.
Right.
Okay. Any other questions from the committee? Senator Morris.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, notwithstanding the fact that I'm really not very comfortable with just tapping bank accounts, is this something that on a one-time basis in connection with our tax amnesty would make sense, or is the cost of setup too great for a one-time implementation?
I don't know the cost of implementation. I think that there are ways to spread that cost or put the cost in other, you know, with other parties besides the state. I don't know that, and I'm sure Department of Revenue has some feelings about that or will develop projections about that. As far as using it one time, I'm not sure I understand exactly what you mean by using it one time.
Well, Madam Chair, in the context of a bill that we have on setting up a tax amnesty, we have a beginning and an end, and you grant those that have not paid the opportunity to pay without penalty, and this could be a strong motivator.
And in effect,
because I was reading your paragraph on the second page of your letter, it said that the Indiana experience, 95%, turned out to be voluntary. Mm-hmm.
I don't know how it would interplay with tax amnesty, except I will tell you that my understanding is that Indiana did exactly that. They had a tax amnesty provision, and these collections were experienced after the amnesty. And they continued to use the data match system on an ongoing basis.
Thank you. Other questions? Senator Telfer.
Thank you. I understand that there are some dollars that are exempt from paying taxes. I know the IRS has certain things that they won't require you to liquidate or whatever. Let's say you've got a Social Security check. Somebody's got a bank balance of $868. It's their only income. It's at and it's a Social Security check, which generally is exempt. How will a bank or the Department of Revenue know this when they go in and sweep the account to pay an outstanding tax liability?
I believe that an agency or a collector is going to have to develop procedures, which they would now. If they go in and they do a garnishment of an account, the bank or the collector is going to have to make a determination as to what's in that account and what it represents. And I don't know specifically, but I'm sure that there have to be rules and procedures to make sure that that does not occur, because those protections do not go away.
And Senator Telfer, Senator Rosenbaum and I are working on a bill to try to protect those kinds of funds in another committee, in the Consumer and Public Affairs Committee. That's a good point. Other questions? Thank you very much. Mr. Yates, did you want to talk specifically on this, or you want to? All right. Is there anybody else who wants to speak on this particular bill? I think as I've told the proponents, we're probably going to incorporate any subject matter of this bill into Senate Bill 690, so that will probably be our vehicle for dealing with the overall area of compliance. And we do have a work group going. Senator Telfer and I have a work group going, and we hope to get something developed in that area. So with that, I'm going to open a work session on Senate Bill 690, but this is going to be a true work session, and that means I'm going to work the audience on this. So I think we'll start out with Mr. Yates and Pam Levitt, if you want to come up with him. Oh, Chris, why don't you summarize it first? Sorry.
Oh, sure. Madam Chair. As you recall from the first public hearing on 690, the policies embodied in here are largely from the report that the Department of Revenue did in response to Senate Bill 1082 from 2008. I will point out, in your packet, there's a bullet sheet highlighting some of the issues that are currently being discussed relating to Senate Bill 690. And those, very briefly, pertain to expanding the disclosure of tax information to local law enforcement, the role of DOR and licensing boards in compliance, and how that might relate to House Bill 3082, which is receiving some attention. The third one, providing additional tax information to the Oregon boards of accountancy and tax practitioners. A lot of the details around the data exchange program that the chair has alluded to. And then details of providing information to consumer reporting agencies. Those are just some of the issues that are being discussed.
Okay. Thank you. So we'll start off, since we've been talking about the data match issue, we'll start off with our friends from the financial community and maybe address that issue and any others you care to address. Welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members of the committee, Ken Yates, Vice President of Government Relations for the Oregon Bankers Association and the Independent Community Banks of Oregon. It's a pleasure to be here. Thank you for the opportunity. It's always a pleasure to be on the same page with our colleagues in the credit union industry. And I will keep my remarks succinct and to the point regarding Senate Bill 690. The Oregon Bankers Association and the Independent Community Banks of Oregon are committed to protecting the privacy of their members' customers from government intrusion unless it's justified. Towards that end, we have several questions and concerns regarding Senate Bill 690. The first one, the bill does not contain a cross-reference to statutes on privacy of financial records, specifically ORS 192.555. No exception to the prohibition against financial institutions disclosing private financial information to state agencies under this bill is provided under that statute. Now, there is a liability exemption in the bill, but it, in terms of proper drafting, we would recommend that exemption be written into ORS 192.555. The same comment would apply to Senate Bill 883. Second, 690, as introduced, does it comply with all federal laws protecting customer financial information? This is simply a question that I raise. I don't know the answer to it, but I hope the committee would consider. Does this comply fully with federal requirements to protect customer privacy as provided by financial institutions to government agencies? Third, Senate Bill 690, as introduced, does not provide how financial institutions will determine which account holders have not paid their taxes or have not filed a petition to the department as to why they did not. Conceivably, this could be done under Section 9 of the bill, where the department reports delinquent taxes to consumer reporting agencies. Is it assumed that financial institutions would get the information from consumer credit agencies to comply with this bill? Fourth and finally, would financial institutions be required to report the information for all of its customer accounts, or just those that they encounter in their review of credit reports in the normal course of business? Or if they receive a request from the Department of Revenue on the specific delinquencies. These questions are not addressed in the bill at this time, as written and introduced, but are fundamental questions of privacy concerning our customers. Quite fundamentally, it is the difference between data mining and data match. This organization would oppose data mining. I was willing to work with the committee and whatever work group is established to work on these issues and address some of these concerns before we can consider the bill further. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, and thank you for your willingness to participate in the work group, because we just started yesterday. We met with the child support people to get kind of an idea of how they do the data match process, and we want to, I think I speak for the entire committee, whatever we do, we want to do it in a way that absolutely protects the privacy. We are totally on the same page.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and indeed we are. Appreciate that.
Thank you. Ms. Leavitt.
Chair Burdick and members of the committee, Pam Leavitt with the Credit Union Association of Oregon. We certainly support the goals of going after some folks who are ignoring their tax bill. My husband and I are writing a check in the several thousands of dollars this month for our taxes, so I want to make sure those not paying taxes pay taxes. However, putting back my Credit Union Association of Oregon hat on, Mr. Yates and I discussed this bill, and we have very similar concerns. Our attorneys looked at Senate Bill 690 and had some concerns with conflicting language. We're limited in ORS 192.555 on sharing information, and so there are certainly some conflicts in the statute. Also, some concerns were raised by our members on our federal and state requirements under the very large Gramm-Leach-Bliley requirements that have passed the federal government, and how, if there were any conflicts. So we certainly understand the goals of the bill. We will follow whatever law the state tells us to do, but we do want to make sure the privacy of our member information is protected. I understand we're going to be having some further discussions, and the credit unions would certainly like to participate so we can add our comments.
And you are hereby invited and appreciated for offering to help.
Madam Chair, one more thing. I handed out, just because I'm trying to educate myself, the Child Support Data Matching Program. Just to give you background, this is the document that we, our compliance department, shares with our credit unions. How do you comply with child support data matching? So I thought that might be of interest. It certainly was of me. It goes through the details of how you comply with the federal law.
It is of great interest. I didn't know where it came from,
yes,
but thank
from
you
me.
For providing that. Thank you very much. Are there questions from the committee? Thank you very much.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Is there anyone else who wants to speak on Senate Bill 690. I've been in this process for 12 years, and I still can't remember bill numbers from 1 minute to the next. Okay. All right. Thank you. We're going to proceed with work sessions, continuing to work with the child support people, continuing to work with the parties, the bankers, the credit unions, and anyone else who might help us get to a resolution on how to better collect taxes without violating people's privacy. Senator Morse.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a question, and I read the bill, but maybe I missed it. What about people that hold accounts in banks that are not outside the state?
That's an issue that we will take up with the bankers for guidance.
Companies that move large sums of money quite often just for the float will bank in Delaware or somewhere on the East Coast.
Yeah. When we talked about when Senator Telfer and I talked to the child support people, this really didn't come up. Of course, when you're talking child support, you're not talking about corporate people by and large. So that's an excellent question. So we will try to delve into that. Senator Telfer.
Madam Chair, they did mention the fact that they have a multi-state agreement of some sort they're all regulated under federal regulations. So it's a little different than I think what we would be doing. I don't know that we'd have multi-state, but there is that sharing ability. So, and again, those are probably corporate accounts, and they're not dealing with corporate accounts.
And the fact of the matter is that any compliance issue, we may not get to everything. But whatever we can get to, we're going to try to.
Well, Madam Chair, I'd hate to see all our local community banks lose deposits because people just didn't trust big government.
Okay. Right.
Okay, we're going to close. Anybody else want to say anything? Okay, we're going to close the work session on Senate Bill 690, and we're going to open a work session on Senate Bill, I believe, 880 is next, right? 880. Okay, Paul, why don't you start us out on this?
Madam Chair, we have requested some amendments. I don't think we've gotten them yet, but I can describe what the progress for Senate Bill 880, and the which is establish a tax amnesty. And keep in mind, okay, you do have the amendments. We just received those. I'll describe what our direction was to council, and then for those amendments, and then emphasize some issues that we think still are very much unresolved for the committee's discussion. I have a one-page outline of those issues labeled tax amnesty policy considerations, and I'll walk through that with you. First of all, just let me remind you what Senate Bill 880 is. It is the final product of the general amnesty program that was established in 2005, and actually that was passed through House Revenue Committee, another version passed through the Senate. So it had a lot of work on it, but those times, of course, are a little different, and some of the issues are considered a little differently. So what we did was had a work group with the chair and the vice chair to go through issues. A number of them were identified when the Sallie Mae folks were here to kind of talk through some of the issues they've encountered in other states, and then the issues that came up in our 2005 experience. And we had Deborah Buchanan from the Department of Revenue was in that discussion. First of all, the eligible tax types, the way the bill originally came out in 2005 was just directed at personal income tax, but the discussions with the department and the work group had decided to expand that. Corporate income taxes were added, and one of the things that I think made an impression was we saw the relatively high proportion of revenue that came in recent amnesties, in particular in Indiana and in Iowa. So that was included. Department of Revenue serves as administrator in local transit taxes. particularly for TriMet and for Lane County, and those should be included in your amendment. The inheritance tax, I've had some discussion of that. This has come up also in a House bill, that the inheritance tax is, of course, something that's grown substantially and now is over $200 million in, per biennium in general fund revenue. And then timber taxes, which have always been kind of complex. And so those were all should all be in the amendment as potential tax programs for the amnesty. These were all programs that are administered by the Department of Revenue. We don't remember there are a number of other taxes that are administered by other agencies. We haven't been in, there's no other agency administered taxes included. The next issue is the incentives for the taxpayer, the carrots part of the carrots and sticks. And the carrot is that penalties would be waived completely, and that is was part of 880 that you that as it came to you. And then there was some discussion about interest, and that's always from a carrot standpoint. Of course, you draw more people in, the more you the more carrots you have. And the discussion of the work group was to look at a partial reduction. And I believe there should be a 50% reduction on interest due in the Dash 1 amendments, rather than full forgiveness of interest for taxpayers who participate in the amnesty. The next issue, and the one that that we think is really a fundamental one for you to decide on, is eligible taxpayers. The original bill requires an application process, so you come in the process, you fill out the application with the Department of Revenue that you want to apply for amnesty. And the two key areas that we think are really the major things for long-term compliance are the non-filers, to get people into the system that are not in the system currently. And secondly, those that want to come in with amend returns that they have offered in the past and to make adjustments that maybe more accurately reflect those tax years. The issue that came up that I think is that is included in your Dash 1, but I think it's still very much an open question, is the accounts receivable issue and whether people that are in the system now that have been identified by the Department of Revenue, whether they should be included in this in the program and be eligible. The original bill did not include them. The primary advantage of including them is you get a lot more gross revenue because there's a lot of people involved. You may have an opportunity of pulling payments forward. The negative side of that is history has shown that most of those accounts receivables are collected at some point, and that you would give up revenue that we would have received otherwise. And what we try to do, and because we have the detailed information from Department of Revenue, we try to go through and estimate what you would have gotten if they hadn't been eligible, and we'll subtract that from the revenue impact estimate. So they try to give you what we think would be the net effect. So that's something we would identify, and that's why I put those two big question marks there. And I know that both the revenue chairs had a brief conversation with Director Harchinko yesterday about this issue. The fourth piece is the post-amnesty compliance measures. The original bill had a 25% penalty, and that has stayed in it. There was some discussion about if there's an installment plan allowed where you come in the amnesty, you don't have the money right now, but you agree to an installment plan. What would happen if you don't follow that plan? The idea is that you would return to current law. You would lose. You wouldn't get the carrots piece of the amnesty if you didn't fulfill it, but you wouldn't have to be this. You wouldn't have to pay this additional 25% penalty because you came in, and so you would go back to current law, in effect. The fifth issue was one that was is problematic, and as you recall, the testimony you got from Sallie Mae on the timing of the amnesty program was a recommendation that it be done between Labor Day and Thanksgiving, and so that would be under most normal statutory changes that you would make in this session would be doable. We put an emergency clause on it. However, with tax legislation that affects the administration of taxes, not just raises revenue, but affects the administration of taxes, you cannot put an emergency clause on. And our discussions with council are that they didn't think it, an emergency clause would be appropriate for this bill because of its effect on the administration of the income tax. So, therefore, that puts you in a situation where you could, what we've done is left it as a June 1 to July 30th in the amendment. But I know the department is not comfortable with that. I would like to see us to do, for you to do whatever possible to move that up to the fall. There's a couple of issues there. One is you do have some concerns about compliance if you say we're going to have an amnesty. You know, if you think about it, we're going to have an amnesty 3 years from now. What that might affect compliance the next 3 years. So, you know, the longer period you have, there's that risk. And so they have some ideas, and Madam Chair, I guess you could ask Deborah to come up, maybe talk a little bit about some of those ideas and what kind of flexibility they have in current statute to, for example, to waive penalties for people that would come in, and then you would, in effect, before the bill has technically become effective in 91 days. So that's an issue out there that would be a major implementation one. The duration of the amnesty, 60 days. The original bill was 90. The 60 days was the recommended amount by Sallie Mae. And, of course, what we've seen in most amnesties is that you get most of the people come in, whatever day you set as the deadline, come in pretty close to that time. Resource allocation, there was some discussion about contracting through an RFP process. If there's significant one-time kinds of costs, and DOR would have to gear up to some extent just to manage the program, even if it is contracted out. The Dash 1s have a contracting process in there. The original 880 did not. Media and outreach program is a critical one in terms of getting participation, and that's DOR and or contractor would market that the program. And finally, we had a couple of other issues that were talked about in the work group. One is the notion of whatever proceeds come in, and given the uncertainty, even for your experienced LRO staff, they occasionally are off in their estimates. This would provide set up a separate fund where these proceeds would go into that fund and then be allocated out of that fund, and something with recognizing that there's even a wider margin of potential error than normal for this kind of one-time kind of project in terms of what behavior response will be. And then the last thing was the notion of a legislative oversight committee. And again, I haven't looked at the language, but what we requested was a four-member oversight committee with two members appointed from the House Revenue Committee and two members appointed from the Senate Finance and Revenue Committee for the interim to give some direction to the Department of Revenue in setting up the program and carrying it out.
Thanks for that excellent summary. Committee, in case you didn't see it, these are what Paul just talked about is summarized in your packet under Senate Bill 880. So, Deborah, why don't you come on up and talk briefly about the issue that we're facing in terms of timing and not being able to do an emergency clause, and what the Revenue Department would propose as an alternative.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Deborah Buchanan with the Department of Revenue. As Paul mentioned, and as I know all of you appreciate, the delay of a year or 18 months in having an amnesty, we think would impact our current collections, our current folks that are on installment plans, people that maybe are thinking about filing returns now and would simply decide to wait. So one possibility is that under current law, the department has broad penalty waiver authority. And if the legislature were to give us perhaps a bit more flexibility for a period of time in interest waiver, we could, with direction from the legislature, to take on an administrative amnesty program. We probably could start that perhaps with an emergency clause, and deal with installment plans that we have now. Taxpayers that are known, offer them a complete waiver of interest. Partial waiver of interest, complete waiver of penalties, and see if we couldn't accelerate collections for that group. Not do an amnesty necessarily this session, but perhaps consider that in the February 2010 session. Take a look at the situation then. That would give us additional time to do planning, to figure out what kind of staffing we would need for that, what kind of marketing program, et cetera. If the February legislature decided to do an amnesty program, that then could take place that fall, because you would have the time period, the 90-day time period would not be a problem at that time. So that's what we're thinking of now, Madam Chair.
Okay, and so for this to work the way you are talking about, you'd have to have legislation to give you more leeway on interest payments, correct?
Madam Chair, that's correct. I think there also might need to be perhaps some funding, if possible, to do an outreach campaign to let these folks know that here's an opportunity to have some waiver if you come forward, or if you're able to put it on a credit card or borrow it or that type of thing. So the media outreach, the broader interest waiver authority, and direction from the legislature that this is what you would like us to do, I think would be important components for us.
Okay. Questions? Thank you very
much.
Okay. Rick, did you want to
talk on
Senator Morse?
If I may.
Deborah, come back.
Still here. I'm not convinced that we can't expedite this bill. We do all kinds of things at the end of session to move bills. Is there any reason why we couldn't have this on the governor's desk by the middle of May?
Unfortunately, Senator Morse, the law is that the clock starts running at sine die.
Oh, that's right. Excuse me.
Yeah.
Back up. Sorry.
Thank you.
That was my first.
I do know that. I just
that was my
that.
First thought as well.
And yeah. Okay. Sorry about that.
I just don't think.
No, there is a solution to that too. We sign a day. May 15th.
I think we'd all vote for that. I think we this entire committee would be unanimous on that.
Can I amend this bill?
Oh, there'll be an amendment.
I think we ought to send the sine die resolution to this committee. All right, Rick, come on up.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Rick Willis with the Public Utility Commission. We, I hope, have an amendment in. I'm not sure if it came through or not. But what it would allow is some information sharing between the PUC and Department of Revenue. We have a program, the PUC, called the Residential Service Protection Fund. And that's a program that provides some communication services to disabled folks and low-income folks. DOR administers a 911 fee program, and that's collected from telecommunications providers. And the law that describes the two programs describes who the fees are collected from for the programs are the same. So in theory, the providers and the information that they provide us should be identical. Well, last summer, Secretary of State's Audit Division did an audit of the program, and lo and behold, there were all kinds of discrepancies, both between who was providing, which companies were providing the fee and how much of the fee they were providing. So it's both discrepancies in the company and in the information they were providing us.
Oh.
So in our wisdom, DOR and PUC thought, well, let's just share the information to see, compare, and look for discrepancies. Well, unfortunately, there is a law that prevents DOR from sharing that information with the PUC. So our amendment would allow them to share it so that we can share ours, they can share theirs, we can look at our RSPF program, they can look at their 911 program, find the discrepancies, resolve those and get those providers to remit the proper amount of revenue to each program.
Thank you. And I think that I'm kind of embarrassed, but I think I was supposed to have you talk about this in connection with another bill, but fascinating information. So hold that thought, committee. This will be coming up again. You're going to have to come back here and say all that again.
Madam Chair, I'd be more than happy to.
I apologize. So you shouldn't have come because you confused me.
I beg your indulgence.
No, I'm teasing you. Okay. Thank you for that report. Are there questions since he's here? Thank you. We're going to close the... anybody else want to talk on 880? Okay. We're going to close the work session on Senate Bill 880 and continue to work on this. And committee, we're going to carry over Senate Bill 180 until next Tuesday's meeting because the amendments still aren't ready. I think that concludes the business of the committee, and we are adjourned.
So we're not meeting.